y'all. Amber Hunt here. We have some news at Crimes of the Centuries. As of now, this show is part of Grab Bag Collab, the Patreon-based podcasting network I founded with Tony Award-winning actor and podcaster Daisy Egan and Amanda Rossman, my longtime collaborator on all things journalism, most notably our hit investigative podcast Accused, which was named a top 25 true crime podcast by Rolling Stone magazine. Now you might be wondering, what does this mean for me? Well, it means that if you're interested in getting early ad-free episodes of Crimes of the Centuries, you can do so at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. And if you do that, you'll have access to a hodgepodge of other shows. Right now, we've got an advice podcast about secrets called Dear Daisy, a gossip-laden game show hosted by Rebecca Lavoie called Other People's Problems, a Love is Blind recap show called Shut the F Up, Nick Lachey with Daisy and Broadway superstar Ellen Marsh, plus much more to come. Here, though, we'll give you a sampling of the show most aligned with Crimes of the Centuries. The Catalyst is a program created, narrated, and edited by Amanda Rossman and me, and co-written by historian Jen Erdman, that delves into the upbringings and evolutions of some of history's worst criminals. This serves as just a taste of what else you'll get over at Grab Bag Collab if you subscribe to support Crimes of the Centuries there, too. Remember, to join, go to patreon.com/grabbagcollab and feel good knowing that whatever money we make there, we share with all of our creators in the hopes of making more content for years to come. Please stay tuned for The Catalyst. People interested in true crime are always baffled by the why. Why would someone do these things? What path in life could possibly have led them to commit such atrocious acts? In this podcast, we aim to explore the upbringings and backgrounds of some of history's worst criminals, but with a twist. Because we want you to set aside what you already know about them, we won't use their names until the end of the show, so you can listen anew and hopefully get insight into the question that haunts us the most. Why did they do it? Join us as we explore The Catalyst. The house still stands, though it's now occupied by an elderly couple who sleep in the room where the landlady once laid out her victims. Where this particular serial killer laid her head at night, these former booksellers invite their guests to sleep. And instead of allowing the residents of F Street in Sacramento to quietly move on from the landlady's horrific crimes, Tom and Barbara instead have sprinkled their property with reminders. Planters in the back garden, where victims were buried, include mosaics of hands raising out of the ground. A sign toward the front of the house warns that trespassers will be drugged and buried in the yard, the exact method of murder committed by the landlady. And then there's the life-size mannequin of the landlady herself, positioned by the front door, still waiting decades after being forcibly removed from the property, as though she's there to welcome more victims. I mean, boarders. The landlady was born January 9th, 1929, just 10 months before the crash that ushered in the Great Depression. Both of her parents struggled with alcohol addiction, with her father seemingly having additional mental health issues, perhaps stemming from his time in World War I. He would often threaten to kill himself in front of his children. That man, James, had served as a private in France during the First World War, and his lungs had been damaged in a gas attack. He is described by sources as a, quote, frail and sickly man, end quote. According to the Los Angeles Times, there are differing accounts on the number of siblings the landlady had. Some say she had six, while others say as many as 17. David Kolzik, in his book on California crimes, called the landlady's mother Trudy, well, names we tend not to use anymore. But in short, he gave the impression that Trudy enjoyed sex, perhaps outside the bounds of her marriage. The landlady was 8 when her father died from tuberculosis. Her mother worked as a sex worker to support her children, though Kolzik claims she was already engaging in sex work before the death of her husband. Between her addiction and non-traditional occupation, Trudy lost custody of her children within a year of James's death, and then died herself by the end of 1938 in a motorcycle accident. The landlady and her siblings were sent to an orphanage during the Great Depression. According to those who testified at her trial, she was the victim of repeated sexual abuse. In Ryan Green's book on this case, the landlady began to create stories that eventually wove a new history that bore little resemblance with her real past. She learned Spanish to be able to tell people she had grown up in Mexico with her gajillion brothers and sisters. She told people that she had been happy and loved before her family moved to the United States, and she lost her adoring parents in a car accident. Throughout her life, she would try to blend into the Mexican communities wherever she lived in an attempt to return to happy memories that had never happened. To escape this rough childhood, the landlady married the first World War II soldier who happened to come along after serving in the Pacific Theater. Age 16 in 1945, she met and married Fred McFall, who was listed as a POW at the hands of the Japanese in a 1943 issue of the Sacramento Bee. In the same short clipping, the toll of the war on the McFall family was detailed. One brother had been declared missing. Another, Ralph, was in a Marine hospital recovering after being wounded in a grenade blast. According to Kolzik's book, the 16-year-old landlady was working as a sex worker in Olympia, Washington, when she met the 22-year-old soldier as he was being mustered out. Per Ryan Green, McFall was perhaps one of her customers who became infatuated with her, quote, booking not just the regular slot, but also extra time just to talk to her, end quote. Almost instantly bored as a housewife, the landlady fell victim to her inherited alcoholism and began to tell lies that grew larger and larger, stories about hanging out with movie stars. Not entirely impossible during World War II, when stars were doing their part at the Hollywood canteen and on USO tours. Those stories soon morphed into harrowing tales of how the landlady was in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, when the United States dropped the first atomic bomb. Boredom flew out the window when the couple contributed two daughters to the baby boom, but the landlady was less than maternal. When you combine her extremely troubled childhood with a difficult labor and the fact that she was only 16, it's perhaps not surprising that she didn't bond with her first child. When McFall came home to find their daughter crawling amidst a dirty floor and a diaper that hadn't been changed all day, the baby was given to his parents to raise. Unsure if their marriage was salvageable, Fred saw the landlady's second pregnancy as a chance to start over. He was convinced she would bond with this baby, but she didn't even tell anyone when she went into labor. Even though she lived in the same area as her in-laws, she took herself to the hospital and, before they finished cleaning the baby up, was already asking about adoption. When Fred's wife returned from the hospital, not pregnant and without a baby, he was obviously confused. She told him the truth. She didn't want the baby, so she had given it up. Shocked, he ran out of the house and began contacting any authorities he could think of, trying to find his newest daughter. But it was too late. All parental rights had been signed away by the mother, and that was that. When Fred served her divorce papers, the landlady didn't bother contesting. She simply packed her bags, gathered whatever cash she had stashed around the house, and hopped on the first train to L.A., Per Ryan Green, not much is known about what happened with Frank McFall or his first daughter with the landlady. They didn't surface, even when the landlady's photo was eventually splashed across the international news. She married her next husband, Axel Bren Johansson, in San Francisco in 1952. Johansson was a merchant seaman, meaning he was out to sea far more than he was home with his new wife. She took advantage of his job to continue living on her terms. Whenever he would leave, the landlady invited men to her empty house and gambled away the money Axel was busy earning. She also continued her lies, which were quickly becoming fantastical and offensive. She created a fake persona and began claiming she was a Muslim woman of supposedly Egyptian and Israeli descent. 9 years into their marriage, Axel had the landlady committed to the DeWitt State Hospital in Auburn, California, after what author Carla Norton called a binge of drinking, lying, criminal behavior, and threats of suicide. Norton, in her book Disturbed Ground, included the landlady's diagnosis, a pathological liar with an unstable personality. 5 years after Axel committed his wife to a state hospital, the couple divorced. But the landlady wasn't finished with Axel Brand Johansson. She kept his surname and just made up a new first name to try to distance herself from her crimes. Her new identity, Sharon Johansson, was a devout Christian woman who was trying to find work as a caregiver, eventually providing sanctuary to young women experiencing poverty and abuse, at no charge, of course. We will call her final husband simply Roberto, as the landlady kept his surname through the rest of her life. They married in 1968, but separated 16 months later when she accused Roberto of assaulting her. She had tried to serve him with divorce papers, but found it difficult when he fled to Mexico. Because of this, their divorce wouldn't be finalized until 1973. 2 years later, the landlady would file a restraining order against the man whose name she would carry with her for the remaining of her 82 years alive. Now, before we leave her marriages, we need to address the crimes she committed while married to her various husbands and those committed in between the divorces and the weddings. After her divorce from Fred McFall, she moved to a tough neighborhood in L.A. and shortly resigned herself to performing sex work to survive. In spring of 1948, possibly while her divorce from McFall was being processed, she was arrested for passing forged checks in Riverside, California. Pleading guilty to 2 counts of forgery, she served 4 months in jail and was sentenced to 3 years probation. She lasted 6 more months in Riverside before leaving for Northern California. In 1960, while married to Johansson, she was arrested in Sacramento for owning and operating a bookkeeping firm as a front for a brothel. Found guilty, she was sentenced to 90 days in the Sacramento County Jail, which played a part in her being committed to the state hospital less than a year later. Following her third, but not final, divorce, she began another boarding house, this time in Sacramento, near 15th and F Streets. To an outside observer, it would appear that the landlady was attempting to start over. Once again, she established herself, or tried to anyway, as a respected member of the city's Hispanic community by donating money to charities, neighborhood schools, and scholarships. She also seemingly let go of her vanity, allowing her hair to turn gray, wearing vintage clothes, and choosing eyeglasses normally worn by the elderly. In hindsight, it seems this image shift was just another part of her con. She needed people to trust her. And who doesn't trust an old lady? In addition to helping the neighborhood kids, she also let the community know that she was a resource for those in need, those suffering from homelessness, mental illness, addiction issues. This help began as actual help, holding Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in her boarding house and helping people sign up to receive Social Security benefits. Her interest in those who came into her boarding house only increased when she got legit tenants. She would be particularly interested in their finances and what checks they received in the mail. According to the Oakland Tribune, she was convicted again in December 1978, this time for federal forgery charges, for which she was sentenced to 7 years probation. A stipulation of her parole was that she was prohibited from operating another boarding house. So she pivoted to being an in-home caregiver, an important distinction, at least for the state of California. It would only take a few short years for the landlady to escalate from forgery to robbery to, "Oh, officer, I don't know what happened. I just found him like this." Her first victim could count himself lucky because he survived his interaction. In January of 1982, the landlady met 74-year-old Malcolm McKenzie at a bar and went back to his apartment with him. He later testified that when they arrived at his place, he collapsed on his bed, saying, "I couldn't move my body or talk, but I could see and hear." Incapacitated, he could do nothing but watch as she, quote, looted his apartment, even taking a small diamond ring his mother once owned from his little finger, end quote. As she left him alive and hadn't tried to hide her face, Malcolm had no problem telling the police exactly what had happened and who had done it. The landlady was convicted in the summer of 1982 of robbery and administering stupefying drugs to commit robbery. Sentenced to 5 years in prison, she was released 2 years early for good behavior. Aside from costing her 3 years, her encounter with Malcolm McKenzie also put a terrible thought into the landlady's mind. Maybe she shouldn't leave her victims alive. Before her conviction and prison term, she managed to get in a few more crimes. Over a few short weeks in the spring, she visited some old friends. Several hours after she surprised one such friend, 49-year-old Dorothy Osborne, with a visit, Dorothy noticed that checks, credit cards, and many other items were missing. Ruth Monroe, 61, wasn't as lucky. According to one of the landlady's appeal filings, Ruth was the first tenant that moved into her house. Before that, she had worked behind the counter at a pharmacy in downtown Sacramento, but she had recently retired. She was in the midst of a divorce, but was described as a, quote, healthy and happy 61-year-old woman, and she was looking forward to living with the defendant rather than living alone, end quote. 2 weeks after arriving at the landlady's house, she called another friend, telling them, I'm so sick, I feel like I'm going to die. 3 days before remains were found, her son, William, visited and, seeing his mother with a cocktail in her hand, asked her about it. She told William it was creme de menthe, something the landlady had been fixing for her to help calm her nerves. Over the next few days, the landlady kept Ruth's children away from her until Ruth died. Initially, her cause of death was listed as respiratory depression caused by an accidental overdose of codeine, something that her ex-husband had been prescribed as part of his cancer treatment. The death would later be reclassified as a homicide. Now, the landlady reported to prison in August of 1982 to serve her sentence for grand theft and forgery. While she was in prison, she gave power of attorney to Ricardo Ordorica, whom she called her nephew and who lived in the basement apartment of the house on F Street. Ordorica cashed her government benefit checks by signing her name to them. While her not-nephew was taking care of her things, the landlady was busy writing letters. Remember, was busy writing letters. Real letters, because remember, this was the 1980s, to new pen pals. One of these unsuspecting pen pals was 77-year-old Everson Theodore Gilmeth, a retired man from Oregon. Described as being in relatively good medical condition, at least for now, Gilmeth moved from Oregon to Sacramento only weeks before his pen pal was to be released. In addition to his good health, the landlady also knew that he received monthly Social Security benefits amounting to $632 plus a pension check of $4,259. Now, those figures add up to nearly $2,000 in today's money. Gilmeth, his truck, his trailer, and his monthly retirement checks moved to Sacramento's F Street. According to government filings, he officially changed his address with the Social Security Administration on August 26, 1985, and arrived in the city on September 1st. The landlady had told Ordorica to expect this new tenant and that the two men would be driving to the prison together to pick her up upon her release. When Gilmeth called his sister back home in Oregon in mid-September, it was the last time she ever heard from him. The landlady was released September 9th, 1985, once again only serving a portion of her sentence. She and Gilmeth opened a joint bank account and seemed to be establishing a new life together. Those around them were further convinced when they began to say they were going to be married on November 2nd. Shortly after she returned to F Street, the landlady hired a handyman named Ismael Flores to do various tasks around the property for a remodel she had planned. One of the first tasks given to Flores was to build a box measuring 30 inches wide, 30 inches deep, and 6 feet long. In payment for this box, the landlady agreed to give him $800 and Gilmeth's truck. The day after Flores finished the box, he found that it had been nailed shut. But if the box was for storage, as the nice lady said, why would they nail it shut? That said, he didn't feel like asking questions, and when she requested that he help her take the box to a storage facility, Flores was surprised to find that the box now weighed about 300 pounds. And the facility she told him about? Well, that never appeared. Instead, her directions brought the two of them to a side of a river where she told him to dump the box into the water. For a fisherman who wanted to start 1986 off with a nice, relaxing day by the Sacramento River, finding the lidless box containing Gilma's body, well, it ended that dream. Of course, having been in the water for a few weeks and with the lid missing, identification proved to be a problem. It would take 2 years before the body was ID'd. The remains had been dressed in boxers and a t-shirt before being wrapped in plastic bags, clear plastic, possibly a shower curtain, and then wrapped in a bedsheet. According to court proceedings, after putting Gilmeth into the box, mothballs and blue toilet deodorizer also had been thrown in. Given the advanced state of decomposition, no definite cause of death could be determined. A few months after his remains were found, Gilmeth's social security checks arrived back at the SSA, stamped return to sender. But in April 1986, the SSA received a letter asking for the checks to be resent, this time to 1426 F Street, signed by Gilmeth. His ghost supposedly also wrote to his sister, saying that he had had a stroke and was now living in Oklahoma with a woman named Irene. A social security check arrived in the name of Everson Gilmeth in the amount of $2,500, or more than $7,000 in today's money, in July. However, his remaining checks were redirected to general delivery in California and were returned uncashed. And this would be a rough outline of the landlady's MO. She would prey on elderly or other vulnerable people who came into her home or her neighborhood. By the end, she would take their checks and their lives. After Gil, quote-unquote, moved to Oklahoma, the landlady began to run a rooming house at 1426 F Street. But remember, the conditions of her parole prohibited her from running a boarding house, so she had to be careful. There were 4 bedrooms on the main floor and 3 more upstairs. The landlady took one of the upstairs rooms for herself, while John McCauley rented another. Her weird not-nephew moved out of the main floor in 1987, allowing her to begin to rent that room as well. To skirt her parole, she told potential tenants that she provided meals, laundry facilities, and a safe place for individuals to live, but her residence was not a boarding care, which would include any kind of living assistance, like providing transportation to and from doctor's appointments. And yet, she told any prospective tenant that she had elder care training and that she was even a, quote, MD doctor, end quote. She also kept track of their appointments on a calendar and often gave them money for cab or bus fare. Now, before anyone starts to have fuzzy feelings about the landlady, let's go over the rules of her house. The most important rule was that no one could get the mail except the landlady. She would collect the mail, pull out all the checks, and then distribute the remaining mail to her tenants. Since there were people with a variety of special needs and/or backgrounds in the house, there were many governmental programs that offered benefits to her tenants, which she cheerfully helped them apply for. Many received welfare checks, Social Security, and maybe some general assistance from the state of California. There were also programs to help low-income people with utility bills and rent. The landlady became the representative payee for her tenants, allowing her to cash or deposit their checks. She also enrolled her tenants in every and any program that would net her money. For each person, this could add up to more than $1,000 each month. With 5 rentable rooms, that's a possible $5,000, or more than $14,000 in today's money, every month in benefits fraud. In short, it was more than enough motive for murder. Betty Mae Palmer moved into the F Street house in late 1986. Before long, the landlady secured a state-issued ID card for Betty, but with her photo on it. Within weeks, Betty's checks were being cashed by the landlady, nearly $7,000 worth. Betty's remains wouldn't be found until November 1988. 78-year-old Leona Carpenter survived an accidental overdose in the fall of 1986. According to court filings, she was known to have chronic addictions to alcohol and prescription drugs, so it didn't raise too many red flags when she presented as an overdose. While recovering in the hospital, the landlady not only kept vigil, but also had a notary come over to the hospital on October 21, 1986, so that she could be given power of attorney over Leona. 10 days later, she was cashing Leona's checks, the amount, again, totaling more than $7,000. She also submitted forged applications in Leona's name for additional benefits in 1986, 87, and 88. Leona returned to the F Street house, but soon went back to the hospital with another, quote-unquote, accidental overdose. By February 1987, her room was available for rent, and Leona's remains would be found in late 1988. If anyone asked, the landlady had told them that Leona had moved into a nursing home. 5 months after moving into the landlady's house, James Gallup, age 62, was diagnosed with a tumor on his colon. He told his oncologist that he wanted to undergo further testing, but any future appointments were canceled by the landlady. She called his doctors and told them James had moved to LA, and she had no idea when he'd be back. His remains would be found in November 1988. Her list of possible victims also includes 58-year-old Eugene Gamel, who was found dead in July 1987. His cause of death was ruled to be suicide, partly because his landlady told officials that Eugene had a history of suicide attempts. She was never charged with his death, but he's long been considered a potential victim. On October 19, 1987, 61-year-old Vera Martin didn't call her daughter on her birthday. She had moved into the landlady's house on October 2nd, so 17 days prior, and 3 days after that, the landlady began forging Vera's checks. Her remains would also be found in November 1988. In a slight change to the landlady's MO, Ricardo Ortega became the representative payee for 65-year-old Dorothy Miller when she moved into one of the upstairs rooms in late October 1987. Disappearing after only a few weeks, the landlady contacted a cleaning company to take care of a large pile of foul-smelling slime in Dorothy's room. In the meantime, she continued to cash Dorothy's checks for more than $11,000. 9 months before her arrest, her fate was sealed when Alvaro Bert Gonzalez Montoya moved into the house in February 1988. Bert had a complicated history. He had been diagnosed as a probable chronic schizophrenic, which made him eligible for assistance benefits. He also suffered from alcohol addiction, having lived at a detoxification center for the previous 5 years. A month after moving into the landlady's house, an application was approved to make her the representative payee for Bert, identifying herself as his cousin. According to court filings, more than $2,000 in checks were sent to the landlady on his behalf. She was said to make sure Bert washed, shaved, ate, and put on clothes each day. She would put his meds by his plate at mealtime, but she would also leave a tab for Bert at an area bar. In early August 1988, Bert seemingly passed out at his local watering hole. After the bartender called the rooming house, two men came and carried him out of the bar. They wouldn't see Bert again. By the end of August, another tenant noticed Bert's room being cleaned out. Then he missed multiple medical appointments, his last on August 29th. When finally asked about it, the landlady said she sent Bert to Mexico to stay with her relatives. Swearing that she was in constant contact, she said he was having a great time and that he'd be returning to California shortly. Meanwhile, she was cashing his checks and using his food stamps and forging his name on various benefit applications. To avoid suspicion, the landlady began cashing checks at a bar close to the house. Checks would arrive a few days after the start of the month, and she would take a group of 4 to 6 of them, totaling about $3,000, to the bar. Telling the bartender that she needed to do it this way because the government couldn't know she had that much income, the bar owner would take them to the bank, cash them, and bring the money back to her. Social workers who had been working with Bert continued in their attempts to contact him. The landlady told them that he was still in Mexico and she didn't know when he would return. When they reminded her that if they didn't see Bert by November 1st, his benefits would be in danger since he had been out of the country for so long, She promised he'd be back on that day, but to no one's surprise, he was nowhere to be found when they returned. Swearing she was going to pick Bert up on the upcoming Saturday, the landlady thought she'd bought herself another few days. But on November 7th, 1988, one of the social workers, Judy Moyes, spoke to a Sacramento police officer and filed a missing persons report. The report gave police enough to open an investigation, and on November 11th, Detective John Cabrera, Detective Terry Brown, and the landlady's parole officer, Jim Wilson, went to 1426 F Street to investigate. Among the people the detective spoke to before going to the house was Brenda Trullio, someone who had served time with the landlady and lived briefly with her after getting released. Trullio said that the landlady had drugged her and cashed her checks, and also that she'd heard reports bodies had been buried in the backyard. And what I imagine to be a Columbo moment where Cabrera says one more thing, Detective Cabrera asked to dig in the backyard. The landlady consented to the digging. While they dug, she was questioned, and even though they found Leona's remains in the backyard, the police still felt they had insufficient evidence to hold her. Besides Leona's remains, the police searched the landlady's bedroom, finding vials of blue capsules and empty medicine bottles with her tenants' names on them. ID cards with her picture, but the names of her tenants, were also found. Additionally, several empty halves of gel caps were in a dresser drawer. The landlady asked if she was under arrest, and Cabrera said no, stating that she was nervous. She asked permission to get a cup of coffee at a nearby hotel. In a move that surprised maybe only Cabrera, she ran. By the time she was arrested 4 days later near L.A., the forensics team plus an anthropologist had uncovered 7 sets of remains. Those remains were later identified as Bert, Leona, Dorothy, Vera, James, Betty May, and another tenant named Benjamin Fink, who had disappeared earlier that year. Benjamin had been buried under a metal shed while a concrete slab was laid over Dorothy's remains. James was discovered under the gazebo. Betty May was the only one to be found in the front of the house, close to the road. Given the timeline of the deaths, the remains were in various stages of decomposition, but for those for whom a toxicology panel could be run, combinations of codeine, diazepam, and flurazepam were found. Flurazepam is a sedative in the same family as Valium, used to induce sleep. Codeine is in the opiate family, prescribed for pain relief. It was more than obvious that those found in the backyard were victims of murder. An arrest warrant was issued November 14, 1988, as stories began to run on TV news and in newspapers. 2 days later, an older woman going by the name Donna Johansson began to chat up an elderly man in a Los Angeles bar. She told him the ways he could increase his assistance checks, and if they moved in together, she could help him file his applications. Giving him the phone number of her hotel and her room number, Donna left, thinking she had another fish on the line. But according to the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the man realized later that he had seen her picture on the news, and he called police. When Donna was arrested, according to court filings, she had little more than $3,000 in cash on her. Given the notoriety of the case, the trial was moved to Monterey County, beginning in February 1993 and culminating in August. Charged with 9 counts of murder, it was alleged that the landlady had willfully, unlawfully, and feloniously, and with malice aforethought, murdered her tenants. While her defense team tried to convince the jury that she was only responsible for the burial of her tenants, not their deaths, the prosecution instructed the jury to consider first or second degree murder, giving them detailed definitions of both. The jury of 8 men and 4 women asked the judge for additional information about poisoning before letting the court know that they had come to a verdict. On August 26, 1993, Dorothea Puente, the death house landlady, the Black Widow of Sacramento, was convicted on 3 counts of murder for Leona Carpenter, Dorothy Miller, and Benjamin Fink. The jury was deadlocked on the remaining counts, Ruth Monroe, Everson Gilmeth, Betty Mae Palmer, James Gallup, Vera Martin, and Bert Montoya, leading to mistrials being declared in their cases. According to the Sacramento Bee, Vera Martin's son, Jerry Hobbs, felt robbed. He said, quote, "It sticks in your craw when you think about your particular case not coming to a close and that it never will be brought to a final conclusion," end quote. And, because you're probably wondering, remember Ismael Flores, who unsuspectingly built a coffin and dumped a body? According to the Sacramento Bee, he was given immunity in exchange for testifying against Puente. Now, she had been eligible for the death penalty, but the jury couldn't agree on that either. On December 10, 1993, Puente was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Her conviction was upheld during an appeal in 1997. She died at the Central California Women's Facility on March 27, 2011, at the age of 82. To research this story, writer Jen Erdman tapped several books, including Disturbed Ground by Carla Norton, California Fruits, Flakes, and Nuts, True Tales of California Crazies, Crackpots, and Creeps by David Kulcik, and Buried Beneath the Boarding House by Ryan Green. Erdman also cited articles from several newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times, the Sacramento Bee, and the Oakland Tribune. The Catalyst is a production of Grab Bag Collab, created and engineered by Amanda Rossman and narrated and edited by Amber Hunt. You can support us and our other programs at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. That's GrabbagCollab. Special thanks to Daisy Egan for being our first pass editor and a collaborator on Grab Bag. Music comes from Soundstripe Inc., my dad, Bruce Hunt, and my son, Hunt Van Benskoten.